Radio India Whiskey. With a delayed beginning of the second half. I think it's one of the first few times. I think we've already done that a few times in the 32 years. Okay. If you guys didn't know it already, the main purpose of the TechNet is education. The curious radio amateurs get together most Sunday evenings, and we discuss our favorite subject, wireless technology, ham radio in particular. The 27 different kinds of ham radio have been pretty well discussed over the last 32 years. And so, if you're the kind of person who is looking for duplication and disappointed by that, you won't be disappointed. Occasionally there's duplication. When you've got 2, 3, and 4 hours worth of people talking to each other every single week for 32 years, there's going to be some duplication. The word standing wave ratio, for instance, gets repeated quite often. And there's probably 40 different ways of looking at standing wave ratio. Each person poses the question slightly differently, and the subject gets discussed slightly differently. If it's a deep enough subject, it's worth repeating from time to time. Let me drop it. And you will occasionally hear errors on the TechNet. No matter how sincere an engineer is, no matter how hard he tries, he's not going to bat 1,000 a certain percentage of the time. He's going to make errors. A smarter engineer will say, okay, I goofed on that one. It's a learning experience. I'm going to go on from there. We've all met the kind of a person who, when an error is brought to his attention, he'll say, that's not what I said, that's not what I meant, and he'll defend it till the cows come home. He's never made an error. That's not a realistic person, from my point of view. There are some controversial subjects that can discuss from time to time on the TechNet. Sometimes we'll leave the discussion one particular week agreeing to disagree and discuss it further the next week, where we bring more resources to bear, more past articles on the subject, references, if you know what I mean. And those references can be in the form of people, articles, technical journals, and so on. And eventually we get closer to what we think is the bottom. But there are certain subjects that are very difficult to discuss because it involves things that cannot be seen, felt, heard, and tasted. And yet we all have mental models as to what the thing really is. And we operate on that mental model, assuming it's the truth. From time to time, you do an experiment that finds an exception to the model. You have to modify the model, and it gets more complicated. Let me drop. I have a philosophy that Mother Nature did not design this universe to be easy for mankind to understand. From all I know, she may not even consider mankind to be one of her best experiments. The New Horizon spacecraft did some marvelous things on Tuesday and the days after, and you'll be hearing more about that as time goes on. And so what we knew about Pluto and what we now know about Pluto has changed significantly, and you'll be hearing about that. Let me drop. A person signs into the technical net because he feels he does have a question or a comment. He does that by giving us his call letters, his name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in to say you're listening. In the very early days, we used to have very long lists of people signing in to say that they're listening. After 32 and a half years, and people signing in from lots of different states and different countries, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. Okay, time for a sign-in. And before we do that, I'll tell you a little bit about what's going to happen. The so-called schedule. For the first hour or so, not necessarily really strictly adhered to, we discuss the general questions and answers. That's followed by John, KC2WGB, who maintains the mailbag for people who don't yet have a ham license or don't yet have the right equipment where they can talk to us directly. So they communicate with John. His website is on the QSN.com site, among other places. He also monitors for us the EchoLink website, by which people who have trouble signing in or want to send him a message can do that. And so he repeats some material to us at the appropriate time. That's followed by Paul and to WS2N, who is our space expert, who will be giving us tonight's space report number 158 of the series. I suspect New Horizons might be mentioned. And I'm also going to be mentioning the fact that there are two very good articles in the New York Times about the super telescope that's going to be built and New Horizons. As I said, there were two very good articles in the New York Times. in-house helps us along those lines. K6DPZ, we've got a lot of experience with lots of pieces of radio equipment. Visit his website and you'll see a
repeater timeout.
If you visit Hal's website, you'll see the seven sisters, the seven warehouse containers he's got full of radio equipment. Okay, we're about to begin. So give me your call letters and name right now to sign in. And try to remember to, each time you're about to transmit to us, even though you get excited because suddenly you're being called upon, try to wait for the full beeps so that we don't time out the machine like I just did. Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
B2RY, Joe?
Yes.
Okay, we've got Joe. And one of the things I do want to bring up again is the man about 2 weeks ago who brought to our attention the so-called CCD antenna. And I read that article and I've got some opinions on that. Anyone else to sign in besides Joe? Because you do have a question or a comment. Call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
Hello, Delta 2 Echo Sierra Yankee. Name's Andy. No question. Just had a little bit of time to come in and listen.
Very fine, Andy. And after Joe and I get into our deepest subjects like we usually do, if you suddenly get a question coming to mind, certainly bring it to our attention. One last call. Anyone else to sign in because you do have a question or a comment for the net? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW. Looks like we're going to have a light night when it comes to sign-ins, in which case we'll have more time to discuss New Horizons and other space craft that NASA is in the process of building. So, Joe, you're the only one on the runway. Not only number one on the runway, you're the only one. W2RYY. Go easy with us, Joe. Sometimes you ask us some pretty tough questions that keep us going for a while. You got it, Joe. K2RIW.
If you can add me to the list. K2RIW.
Eric is on the list. Go ahead then, Joe.
Okay. Eric, do you have a complicated question or a simple question? If you'd like, you can jump ahead and, if that's what you want to do.
Eric, do you want to go first or do you want to go second? Eric, it's your choice.
No, I'll go second. There's no problem.
Okay. Sounds like you've got some time. Go right ahead, Joe.
ESY, actually, I do have a question.
Okay, ESY. Andy has a question. All right, so Andy went from a no to a yes. You're on the list, Andy. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, this one's about an antenna that's been around for a while that I've noticed is kind of interesting the way it's physically constructed, and I kind of wonder why I haven't seen this type of antenna used on lower frequencies because of the way it happens to work. And it happens to be the antenna you've probably seen on many, many vehicles going back to the early cellular days where people had mobiles in the vehicle, and some commercial 800 meg radios systems use mobiles with this kind of antenna also. It's the antenna with the little curlicue is about the first third of the antenna. Typically used for 800 megahertz. And how I understand the thing is, it's a three-quarter wave over a half-wave antenna design. Do you know much about these, Dick?
When it comes to designing mobile antennas for sometimes multiple frequencies and sometimes you want gain out of the antenna, there's a very large number of ways you can put the loading coil and other doodads on the antenna. The loading coil itself, in the case of an antenna that you intentionally make it too short, the loading coil is giving you some of the extra length. A short antenna is highly capacitive, and by adding a series inductor, you get rid of an awful lot of the capacitive reactants, and you bring the antenna back into resonance. You lower its frequency, so to speak. For the kinds of antennas where you want the radiator to give you maximum gain on the horizon, one of the ways of doing that is a so-called 5/8 wave. Instead of the vertical radiator being a quarter wave long, you make it 5/8 of a wave long, and that gives you a maximum pattern on the horizon. If you slowly increase the length of the radiator and keep resonating it, you find that at 5/8 wave, you get the maximum signal on the horizon. As you go beyond 5/8 wave, the signal on the horizon starts going back down again. The next step beyond that is to build a vertical collinear antenna. That's where you've got a radiating element at the bottom, and then collinear with that, you've got another half-wave-like radiator above that. Now you're building a two-element phased array, which has omnidirectional pattern. And the way you adjust that loading coil in between the bottom radiator and the upper radiator, there's lots and lots of ways of doing that. Let me drop. And one of the funny things that happens with coaxial transmission lines, for instance, is that whenever a transmission line is exactly a half wavelength long, it repeats the impedance. Whatever load you put on the far end of a half wavelength or multiples of a half wavelength, you get the exact same impedance on the input end. If the transmission line is approximately a quarter wavelength long, you get impedance inversion. A short circuit at one end is an open circuit at the other end. A capacitor reactance at one end is an inductor reactance at the other end. It gives you a complete inversion if it's a quarter wavelength long. So there are ways you can wind that loading coil so that it is electronically more than a quarter wavelength long, where it starts giving you impedance inversion. And therefore, even though you've added a coil that under normal circumstances is an inductor, at the frequency you're operating at and the way you're loading it with the rest of the antenna, it could act as a capacitor. I know that sounds crazy. How in the world can I put an inductor in there and act like a capacitor? If you electronically make it more than a quarter wavelength long, or is it more than half wave, one or the other, when you make it long enough, instead of getting inductance, you start getting inversion, you start getting capacitance. So there's a zillion ways of putting the loading coil into a radiator, a vertical ground plane-like antenna. Let me drop. And one of the things I want to bring to our attention is that so-called CCD antenna was brought to our attention about 2 weeks ago. And there are also lots and lots of articles in QST Magazine in which they tell you, I've made this modification to the antenna such that the high current area near the bottom has been extended. I've now got a longer length of radiator with high current because of the way I've designed this radiator with reactors and top hat capacitors and so on. And so because you've got a longer length of high current, therefore you've got increased radiation, therefore you've got higher gain, and you get higher efficiency. Good sounding words, not true most of the time. Because if your antenna is made out of low loss materials, which means it's going to run ice cold, and as long as by one means or another, an antenna tuner or the antenna itself, you've got a good impedance match, you put 100 watts into that antenna, and if it's going to radiate 100 watts, whether it does it from a 10% chunk of antenna down at the bottom, or if it does it for the whole 50% length or whatever, is a very minor change. Because that alone doesn't give you a significant difference in pattern. That alone, therefore, doesn't give you a significant difference in gain. And even though you've got a longer length that's doing the radiating, it just means that the amount of bounces the signal has to go back and forth before it finally all gets radiated is a smaller number of bounces. But still, all the signal's going to be radiated. Let me drop. You think because you've got a longer length of high current area, you're going to have higher gain. Good sounding theory on paper, not in reality. The only way you get gain is with directivity. The only way you get directivity is with length. You have to establish real estate. A collinear antenna, a vertical collinear antenna, is multiple elements vertically stacked, so there is more vertical length to create the interferometry characteristic. I got a intimate connection here. It's a longer length of a radiator, which means you get a smaller number of bounces, but still, as long as you've got high efficiency materials and you're not burning up your power into form of heat, it's all going to be get radiated. You only get higher gain, higher directivity, out of multiple wavelengths or multiple radiator sections. It takes interferometry, it takes real estate to establish gain. All kinds of people have done minor things to a dipole, for instance, and they think they've now got the dipole, it's going to have 5 dB more gain. Well, you believe that, and Joe and I are going to sell you some of the bridge that we own. Sometimes we sell some of the Verrazano, and sometimes we sell some of the Brooklyn. So even though there's a loading coil there, and you think it's an inductor, in some cases it can act like a capacitor if you make it long enough, Joe, because of this impedance inversion jazz. If the inductor is electronically more than, it's even more than a quarter wave or half wave, but if you make it long enough, you stupid, Joe. Drag your feet because other people on the frequency have got more experience on this area. W-H-U-R-Y-Y. T-H-U-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Well, I know the antenna is using what appears to be inductive power. It was explained to me many years ago when I asked about somebody fairly intelligent about this antenna design. He said the coil has so much inductance that things start acting like capacitor. But basic question is, I've only seen this used at 800 megahertz antennas. I've never seen it used on lower frequencies. There are manufacturers that make gain antennas on lower frequencies, like in the UHF section, but they use something that resembles an insulated type of object between parts of the antenna to act like a capacitor. They don't use a type of coil on such high inductance that it acts like a capacitor within itself. That was my basic question. It's kind of like an oddity type of thing.
When it comes to vertical collinear antennas that have really high gain, the most famous one is the so-called Station Master. And if you really take one of those apart, you'll find a whole bunch of half-wavelength long pieces of semi-rigid cable, all collinear stacked one above the other, and at each intersection, the center conductor and the shield get reversed. And the reason for that is if I get a pair of vertical dipoles that are both acting in phase with each other, it really means the upper end of one and the lower end of the other are 180 degrees out of phase at that point. And therefore, we're doing this crisscrossing of center conductor and shield, piece them correctly. So a 3, 5, 7 element collinear antenna has got a bunch of these little half-wavelength chunks of semi-rigid cable acting as half-wave dipoles, and they're all being fed in phase when you do it just correctly. If you're willing to have an extremely narrow-band antenna, let me drop this. There's a kind of a design where the individual pieces of half-wavelength or radiator have what looks like an inductor in between them. In some cases, it's an inductor with a small capacitor, with the right kind of a tuned circuit in between each of the half-wavelength sections. Although it's a more narrow-band antenna, again, it can become a collinear. That resonator in between the sections allows 180 degrees of phase shift, which allows them to all act in a co-phase manner. So, in all cases, as you can see, antennas with gain must occupy more real estate electronically. The exception to that is a Yagi-like antenna, where the extra real estate it occupies is in the direction of propagation, the length of the bulb, but still there's more real estate there. So whenever you want gain, you've got to establish, you've got to invest in real estate. You can't make a quarter wavelength long antenna have 10 dB of gain. You're way beyond the laws of physics if you think you can do that, because the gain comes from one end versus the other end, giving you an interferometry effect, giving you a beam width, giving you a null, some number of degrees off of the main lobe. And let me drop this. When it comes to 800 megs, where you're allowed to make, because the frequency is high enough, the wavelength is short enough, there's all kinds of crafty ways. You can make a 2, 3, and 4 element antenna that look like one continuous piece of wire, which is just wound into curlicues into certain sections. You're moving in the direction of that collinear antenna with tuned circuits in between the sections. Lots and lots of different ways of doing it. And the appropriate section of the antenna engineering handbook will give you some pretty strong clues about some of the successful designs along those lines. And so by measuring the number of turns of that coil, the diameter of the coil, the length of the coil, let me drop this. And you know the frequency of operation. You therefore can go to the chapter 2, I think it is, of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, where there is a formula where you know those parameters of the coil and you know the frequency of operation. You can calculate exactly how much inductive reactance it has and whether or not it's starting to act like a capacitor because it's electronically so long. So you could, step by step, study the individual subsections of that antenna and figure out what's going on if you wanted to, Joe. I didn't say it's easy, but you being the scientist type that likes looking into things, you might not want to give up on this one. You might like to know, I think you really like to know how it works. That's why you're asking this question. And as you can tell, I'm giving you a number of speculations. As you've heard me say so often, there's 5,000 kinds of antennas out there, in my belief. And a high percentage of those various configurations of a vertical ground plane antenna. Over to you, Joe. Good question. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W. You didn't get an exact answer because we don't know yet. You got it, Joe.
Okay, very good. I think the antenna is nominally rated for about 3 or something like that dB of gain, if I want to remember. And they're fairly, you know, moderately broad in their bandwidth. But I just brought up because it's a kind of interesting topic, because as I said, I haven't seen that type of design where it has an antenna has a coil in the bottom third of the antenna that's used on other bands. You know, if you like electrically or physically link to the whole antenna by design to make it work in UHF, but I haven't seen that design used in UHF, at least not yet. I've seen other, you know, variations of that to put a capacitor between the elements. But okay, that's it for this question. I'll go on to the next questionnaire.
Very fine, Joe. And keep thinking up those good questions. Andy, what's the latest in Jericho, New York, which is very close to me? You're in my backyard. You and I could be talking to each other on Simplex. KD2ESY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Andy.
Thank you, KD2ESY. I should climb on my roof and try 10.8 miles, whatever it was. Question's kind of simple, at least I think. And regarding New Horizon, my son and I were chatting the other night, and he's very fascinated about space, planet, universe. For this satellite to travel, what is it, 4.3 or 3.4 miles, calculate a trajectory and the gravity of all the planets, how the heck can they aim this thing at a little rock floating out there that far, and what is the power supply that is going to last that long?
Darn good question. And by way of the Mike number 1 and Mike number 2 websites, a number of these articles describing the design and the trajectory are going to be described. There's a fairly nice article in the July 14th issue of New York Times Magazine on page A21 called Pluto Comes into Focus. Very nice article. And you have fallen victim, Andy, into the diagrams we all see in the books for all of these years. Whenever a diagram of the solar system is depicted, you see a great big curved yellow-shaped object on the left-hand side representing the sun, and you see a bunch of, you see the 9 planets displayed in the right order, but the spacing and sizes of the planets. If the planets were shown to scale size, in some cases there would be a dot alongside of the sun. You wouldn't see it. But they're expanding the size of the planets, and the distances are being exaggerated by 10,000 to 1 in some cases. Let me drop. The densest portion of our solar system is the 4 inner rocky planets, Mercury, Venus, Mars, and Earth. Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars in that order. Those are the rocky planets, and outside of that is the so-called big gas giants. Those 4 rocky planets are very closely spaced together compared to the other planets. Okay? How close are they? Mars is very close to 1/2 the diameter of the Earth. So if I want to take objects that you and I are familiar with that have a 2-to-1 ratio that are round, I'd use a 50-cent piece and a dime. So if I represent just those two planets, Earth and Mars, 50-cent piece and dime. Earth is the 50-cent piece, and Mars is the dime. And now I want to put them on my table at the scale distance in that simple diagram you and I are drawing. Mars would have to be 1/2 mile away. The dime would be 1/2 mile away from the 50-cent piece. That is the real scale spacing between Mars and Earth at the instant we sent the Curiosity spacecraft to Mars. As you can see, even in the dense portion of the universe and the solar system, the planets are very far apart. And the distance between them gets multiplied by 2, 3, and 4 times when you go to the outer gas planets. Let me drop. And I think it was you or someone else last week who asked the question, gee, when you launch a New Horizons, how do you make sure that the signal coming is not being shadowed by the other planets? When you've got those kind of spacings, there is no such thing as shadowing. and you think that the spacecraft is going to be influenced by, it's aiming toward Pluto, and you think on the way it's going to be influenced by everything else that's there. Absolutely not. When you launch a spacecraft away from Earth, the first thing you're nearby, depending on the portion of the month, is the moon. But in the case of New Horizons, it zipped by the moon in 9 hours, as opposed to the 3 days that it took for the Apollo 11 astronauts. So this thing was really booking. It was going 36,000 miles an hour compared to the Earth. The Earth itself, in its orbit around the sun, moves at 66,000 miles an hour. So the real speed compared to the Earth was close to 90,000 miles an hour. And the way we aimed it, we launched it at the right time so that you would think you were aiming it toward Pluto. We aimed it toward Jupiter. Jupiter was on the way. At the instant of launching of New Horizons, let me drop it. If I drew a top diagram of the solar system, the Earth was at around 11:30 on that diagram. Jupiter was around 9 o'clock on that diagram, and Pluto was around 6 o'clock on the diagram. So the Earth is going counterclockwise in its orbit around the sun, so it's at 11:30, moving 66,000 miles an hour to the left. That's the time we launched it. And by launching it at that time, it had a real high-speed trip between Earth at 11:30 and Jupiter way out there at 9 o'clock, way far out compared to the Earth. So we launched it, literally aimed it at Jupiter, just a little bit to the outside edge of Jupiter. The New Horizons went zipping by the outside edge of Jupiter and got a gravity assist. It got a slingshot effect, and that added another quite a few thousand miles an hour to its speed. But as it zipped around Jupiter, affected by Jupiter's gravity, even though it was aimed somewhat outwards, and Jupiter curved its path from outward to downward, and it ended up moving directly toward Pluto. And from there on, it encountered no other planets. You've read about the way we discovered Neptune. We discovered Neptune by looking at a perturbation in the orbit of Uranus, and the amount of perturbation was extremely small. It took very accurate measurements to just barely detect the difference of Neptune sitting out there continuously for years on end. You saw a little bit of deviation of the path that the planet Uranus took, and that's how they knew to go look for Uranus, for Neptune. By the same token, Neptune had an extremely minor variation in its orbit, and it helped Mr. Kleinbauer, I think it was, in 1930, look for Pluto. So the distances are huge, and so therefore, when you launch a spacecraft, other than aiming it toward Jupiter like they did, let me drop it. You think you're really going between the gravitational forces of each individual planet. You literally aimed almost dead center for Jupiter in order to get that slingshot effect. Other than that, you're not really flying between the planets. You're an object that's in an orbit around the sun. And it's only the sun that's doing 99% of your effect on velocity and time and whatever. So it was a solar object called New Horizons that flew out there to Pluto. Pluto is not millions of miles out. It is billions, big B. Roughly 3 and a fraction billion miles away is where Jupiter is. At the speed of light, it takes 4.25 or 4.5 hours for the signal to go one way, and another 4.5 hours for it to come back. So 8 or 9 hours is the round-trip communication path to Pluto. The power supply is nuclear. When you're that far away from the sun, let me drop it. There's nowhere near enough solar radiation to operate a set of solar cells. So it has a nuclear power supply. The nuclear power supply, when it was brand new, was putting out something close to 200 watts. 9.5 years later, it was launched in January 19th, I think it was, of 2006. 9.5 years later, the nearly 200 watts output of that nuclear power supply is now down to something in the vicinity of 150 watts. And so the nuclear power supply, plutonium, I think it is, slowly decaying, giving off heat. What was that again?
Plutonium-238, and this one is not a stowing engine. This one's a thermocouple.
So the plutonium-238, radioactive substance with a half-life of, what's the half-life of that roughly, Eric? Probably 1,000 years over you, Eric?
2,000 years.
What was that again? You spoke too fast. What was that again, Eric?
I believe 238 tap light, 15,000 years.
Okay, so 15,000 years is the half-life of the plutonium-238 that was the fuel on this nuclear power supply. And the heat given off by that goes into thermocouples with a heat sink on the outside. The difference in temperature between the hot inside and the cold outside, just like a so-called Peltier device operating backwards, it allows you to generate nearly 200 watts when it was brand new, and I think it's down to 140 or 150 watts.
The heating is the thermocouple, not the fuel.
Yeah, good point. It is the wear and tear on the thermocouples that's giving you the decrease in power, not the half-life of the plutonium. If the thermocouples were not being slowly eaten up, so to speak, you'd get power out of this thing for 1,000 years. So it slowly is degrading in power, and that tells them how many experiments they can run simultaneously. They've got two separate traveling wave tubes that run 12 watts output each, and in theory, if they were able to run both tubes simultaneously, they've got twice the amount of power in the downlink, and therefore, instead of 160, or is it 600? I think it's 600 bits per second. They could be transmitting close to twice that rate if they could use both tubes simultaneously. But now they've done the calculation that they would have to turn off some other experiment while running the two tubes at the same time. It's going to take you as much as 16 months to download all of the data that's in memory in the New Horizons spacecraft as it zipped by Pluto. And what you've only seen so far is a little picture of a little section of a high-resolution picture of Pluto, and a little bit of a section of the nearest moon. And so there's a tremendous amount of data on board, ready to be downloaded. And when you're sending a 12-watt signal, roughly 3 and a fraction billion miles down to the Goldstone 240-foot dish in California, one of the three dishes that listens to this thing, and then you slowly get that data back. And so there's a lot more interesting information that's going to be coming from New Horizons, and Paul a little bit later is going to tell us more about that. So this is some of what I know about New Horizons, Andy. KD2ESY, good question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Paul, WS2NI. It's supposed to be 87 years, 87 years. That's all, half-life on the plutonium.
But the thermocouples don't last anywhere near that long. So 87 years, and we're down to half-life probably in 15 years, if you know what I mean, of the thermocouples. Go right ahead, Andy. Wait for the beep.
Gotcha.
Thank you very much, Dick. I appreciate it. Very interesting. There's more, a lot more to read. I think my son will be very interested with those facts. I will, I'm going to have to run. Hopefully I'll catch you again later on this evening. KD2ESY, be clear. Thank you again.
There you go. Let's give him one more piece of your puzzle with the coins. I could add one more thing to that. You got a half mile. Give him the last piece.
Yeah, when we sent that spacecraft called Curiosity, the spacecraft that's about the size of a Volkswagen, and we sent it to Mars, you could say that the distance between Earth and Mars was a half mile between the 50 cent piece and the dime, and they landed on the right letter of the dime a half mile away. It gives you some idea of the accuracy requirement of the navigation. You want to add to that, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
One other piece that we talked about, oh, I don't know, months ago, was you take that half mile, you know, the distance between here and Mars, and then the distance between here and Pluto, it's 25 times further than the distance between here and Mars. So that gives you an idea where to put the planet Pluto on your map. Back to you, Dick.
I just looked it up. I made a mistake. Paul's right. 238 is 87.7 years. 239 is 24,100 years.
Yeah, these nuclear power supplies are the right way to go when it comes to deep space projects. And so that, in theory, was the fastest launch that we've ever made. New Horizons is about the size of a grand piano. And Paul's going to tell us how much it weighs. I'm going to guess it's around 1,500 pounds or so. And we really sent it out of here with a high-power rocket. And it had to traverse three and a fraction billion miles as a call signal. It's a billion, if you know what I mean. And when I read the reports that Mike number two has brought to my attention, which eventually I think is going to go on the website, LimeRockTechNet.com, you'll be able to read the real uplink and real downlink frequency. Roughly 7.2 gigahertz is the way you communicate with it in the uplink, and it transmits a signal back down to you at roughly 8.1 gigahertz, and almost the same ratio as the other spacecraft, and it's got a slightly different design than the normal deep space networks, and it does have a very accurate oscillator on board, so the design is a bit different than some of the other, but 12 watts downlink, 2.1 meter diameter dish, 46 or so dB of gain. The downlink dish transmitting the signal back to Goldstone from New Horizons. It's got a 1.3 degree beam width. That means you've got to aim that dish from New Horizons all the way back 3 billion miles to the Earth. You've got to aim it within the nearest plus or minus 0.1 or 0.2 degrees. It's got a very accurate navigation system on board to do that, as you can tell. Any further questions about New Horizons right now? Now's the right time. Give us your call letters and name. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay,
KC2FHO.
KC2FHO, I think it is. Correctly on the call letters. Give us your name and then proceed with your question, sir.
Okay, about me, Dick.
Yeah, K2RIW, Kilo Charlie 2 Sierra Hotel Oscar, John in Mount Laurel. Just a comment, quick comment, that I once read that someone built a scale model of the universe. I believe it traverses almost all of Europe. It's been a long time since I read about that, but that would be an interesting thing to visit each planet of the scale model. Go ahead.
Good information, John. And yes, the spacing between the planets, the real spacing, is huge. And the size of the planets, by comparison to the spacing, is extremely small. The size of the planets compared to the size of the sun, extremely small. You take something as big as Venus, which is almost the size of the Earth, and during once every 80 years or whatever it is that Venus will pass in front of the sun, and I've witnessed one of those Venus occultations of the sun. You see this tiny little round dot with a telescope walking across the sun. And that thing is like one third of the distance between us and the sun, which makes it look bigger. And still, as I said, it's a tiny round black dot walking across the sun during one of those events. So when it comes to the size of the planets and the distances between them, all the diagrams we've seen in the books have given us a huge error by 1,000 to 1 or 10,000 to 1. That's not the way it really looks. And it's too bad we've all got that misimpression. Hey, Eric, what's the latest in your world, and how are those wireless photons are treating you? KE2EJ, our local broadcast engineer, K2RIW, the TechNet. You've got it, Eric.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Slightly different subject here. Although I do have a curious question about the Deep Space Network in terms of how they, Goldstone is just one antenna. And with all the vehicles that they have out there, they have a scheduling issue. How do they deal with the Earth's rotation? I know there's a couple of different sites, but are they doing the kind of thing where two downlinks can look at the same bird at the same time? You know, as it passes from one downlink station to the other. But my real question that I first wanted to talk to you about is about single-layer planar spiral coil inductors, okay, and I've been working on a project, and I'm using the expressions developed by Wheeler, but I've got a couple of interesting questions I want to run by you. First of all, let me let it drop. There's lots of different shapes that you can use, but I'm just going to do it real simple, and I'm going to use a circular layout. And this is basically going to be a printed circuit coil, and I'm going to use it. Actually, one of them is going to be a multiplier. And my questions are, actually, in terms of, I know that the thickness of the copper that I use, by the way, it's going to be on FL4.
really sort of irrelevant until I get way up there in frequency. But we're talking about a coil which has no, it doesn't have a high permeability coefficient, no iron here. And at the lower frequencies, the size of the coil, the inductor, it's going to be rather large. So there's going to be a certain amount of radiation, let's call it. Now, you do the opposite, Sam. I'm going to do the opposite. You're trying to use a printed circuit board to make an antenna and have it radiate. Okay, I want to make a high-Q inductor, and I want to keep the losses as low as possible, and I want to keep the magnetic path for those that there's no cross-coupling to any other devices. I'm looking for your experience, if you have any, in that realm. And actually, one of them's going to be a multiplier, so it's going to be tapped. It's RIW, K2J.
Yeah, good question, Eric. In order to understand the physics of what you're operating with, I would look at the section of the Antenna Engineering Handbook on something called cavity-backed spiral antennas. This is an antenna that intentionally radiates. Yes, it's a completely planar, flat, equiangular spiral, which ordinarily would radiate both forward and backwards at right angles to the printed circuit board. And by putting a cavity with absorbing material in the back of the thing, you force it to radiate only in one direction. And when properly designed, these things can have 10 to 1, 20 to 1 frequency ratio between the highest frequency, which is radiated by the center coil, and the lowest frequency, which is the outer perimeter. And you feed it in a twin lead manner in the center with something called the Marchand balance. That balance takes your coaxial cable input, creates a perfect twin lead feed, so to speak, and the twin lead is welded to the center of that spiral. So that thing radiates. Let me drop. A little bit like a log periodic. The signal travels along the wires, starting in the center, and goes out to the point where the perimeter is approximately one wavelength, and then it starts its radiation. It's approximately a circular polarized wave. Go to a lower frequency, and the signal goes a little bit further along that spiral until it hits the outer perimeter, where, again, the diameter is about one wavelength. That's where it does the radiation. Very similar to a loop antenna you and I might build at 80 or 40 meters, and we build a loop with one wavelength of circumference. That's where it does the majority of the radiation. Because you've got a cavity-backed with an absorber on one side, it doesn't radiate in that direction. In your particular case, where you're building a flat inductor, you're trying to save space, but you don't want it to radiate. There's about three things you can do to stop it from radiating. Let me drop.
Oh, I can put a can around it. I really don't want to do that.
I wasn't going there yet. One of the main concepts of all antennas that's not well documented in any of the books is that you resonate first, then it will radiate. In the case of a spiral antenna, resonance is defined as having a diameter of one wavelength. You lay the thing out small enough so that none of the frequencies you're operating at give you the geometry where there is a circumference of one wavelength. That will drastically decrease the radiation. That's step number one. Step number two, you can build it as a tri-plate strip line. In other words, you've got a ground plane behind acting as a shield. You've got a ground plane in the front acting as a shield. You do all of that. I think the amount of radiation from your coil can be cut down by 20 dB, 30 dB, by doing the combination of small enough that it's non-resonant and shielded well enough that the front and back, where the normal mode of spiral radiation is being suppressed. You put that all together, use high enough conductivity materials, use the right dielectric constant of the board, which again will give you some shrinkage of size. I'm pretty sure you can make an inductor taking up very little volume. It's not going to take up some real estate on the board because of its length and width, but the height can be made extremely low if that's what you want to do, and you can even stack multiple above each other if you need more inductance. So those are the three things I would do to stop it from radiating. And if you do it just right, I think you can build a pretty high Q inductor in this manner, Joe. Here we go, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
K2LIW, K2EJ. Now, I've been thinking about that. as a way to stop the radiation. Now, I have to take into consideration, how does that change the inductance in the Q of the coil as I enclose it in, this, in essence, a non-resonant cavity?
2JAS. I heard blank JAS. Blank JAS, give us the full call and your name, and are you giving us some information on this subject? Go right ahead.
This is Kilo 2, Juliet Alpha, Sienna. Name is Roger. No, I do not have information on this subject, but I did want to ask a question of you as soon as you get a chance. Go ahead.
Very fine, Roger. I'm glad you gave us that information. And after Eric, you got one other person. Let's see, no, John already gave us that information. So you're going to be right after Eric. And this section of the TechNet, we still got some time left. And we don't stick to a real strict schedule. As you put shielding around your coil, the back plane and the front plane, without a doubt, you're lowering the inductance. And the amount of inductance you get is really a function of how much magnetic field you can encompass around that coil. And you're squeezing down the magnetic field. Anything you can do to increase the spacing between the coil and the back plane and the coil and the front plane will increase the Q. There are methods by which, with computer modeling programs, you can estimate the inductance you're going to get out of this thing, and you can start playing with those thicknesses and dielectric constant of materials. I still feel that if you're willing to put enough turns, tight enough tact, even in this shielded structure that we've just described, I still think you can make a rather high performance inductor out of that. What frequency do you intend to operate at, Eric? What number of picohenries or nanohenries or millihenries of inductance would you like to create? And what kind of Q do you think you are looking for? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, we're going to start with a 12 megahertz oscillator. We're going to turn it into a triplet. So, naturally, we don't really want to shoot it all that high, but the inductance is very, according to the frequency, is going to be part of a Colpitts oscillator, the first part of it. Once I get that working and use it as not only an oscillator, but a tripler at the same time, that's my goal. Because I'm trying to do this with surface mount stuff, keep it on a tiny little board if I can possibly do it. After that, we need to add a tripler and then a doubler.
There are a number of very respected brand names, vendors of surface mount inductors out there. There's probably at least five brand names, Eric. And so those manufacturers have been down the road you're going down where they want to create a lot of inductance, high Q, small package, and a low loss and little radiation. There are various vendors that have been down that road.
I looked at a number of them, including mini-circuits. My problem is I need to tap it because I need to get the third harmonic.
Guarantee there are ways that you can put a pair of these printed circuit inductors side by side, and therefore the junction between the two could become the tap.
I tried that, and the values don't come out right.
And there's one other slim possibility. You may be able to dig into the package of a commercially made product to establish your tap. I didn't say that's easy, but you've got the technology with the micro manipulation tools, with your high power stereo zoom microscope. I'm having some fun with him on this one, where you could be doing that, Eric. So whether or not you fabricate it yourself, or whether or not you make a modification to an already existing military product or a commercial product, that's one of the choices you can make. And so when you study the design of other people who have been down this road, that'll also give you a lot of hints as to how to do this. I bet you some of those guys have laid out that coil with very high dielectric materials like barium and tetratitanate. Over to you, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW.
Commenting.
Yeah, I did a second job. Actually, I've seen some interesting stuff done at microwave frequency. You know, my intent was to print this stuff on the board. But yeah, I didn't look in some other. I mean, there are other ways to do it, but I had a particular design in mind, and I did actually. It wasn't my idea in essence to start with a planetite of quails, because a lot of stuff that I work on, I'm not talking about zip line stuff, where they use these coils, printed coils, and some of them actually have multiple taps where you can pick off the second harmonic and do one thing with it, pick off the third harmonic all from the same oscillator, which is really cool. Moving on from that, I'm sure if I search, I can find the actual formulas for dealing with the physical volume of a container around a coil and calculate its effects. The other thing I'm dealing with, which I've actually got myself some really fast pin diodes, I'm playing with them right now, and these things react in microseconds, not milliseconds. And the ones that I got will be able to deal with transistors putting out 50, 60 watts. So that's my other little project to make the amplifier for the DMR. I'll let you know how that goes. And by the way, did you ever find my email? If you didn't, I'll send you another one.
And be a little bit careful with pin diodes. The actual positive, intrinsic, negative, the intrinsic area has a certain carrier lifetime, or is it minority or majority carrier lifetime, where as you make the pin diode operate faster and faster, it means the lowest frequency where you can use it effectively gets higher and higher. And eventually, if you go below that frequency, it's not a pin, it's an ordinary rectifying diode, and it'll do some nasty things to your RF waveform. When you're down at a frequency as low as 3 or so megahertz, and you want a pin diode that's fast, you've got a conflict of interest. You might be better for...
We're talking 400 megahertz here.
Okay. Now, at 400 megahertz, there are a number of well-made, very compact, commercially made oscillator assemblies. You could write a check and buy one of those and make the problem go away. What makes you think you've got to fabricate this yourself, Eric? Over to you.
Well, the concept is real simple, actually, is the DMR repeater. Lots of guys would raise cheese with only 4 watts, and I'd like to turn it into like 30. And I can do that with a little Japanese block, so I'm not actually building the amplifier. I just need to be able to switch the thing in and out fast enough.
You've got to switch something in and out roughly how fast for DMR operation, Eric Red?
The DMR packet is 30, it's either 20, I'm now, 28 milliseconds wide. There's a 2 millisecond guard band on the on time and the off time, so, you know, in terms of microseconds, we're talking really slow.
By the way, you did mail me an email on the subject of the modulation techniques used with Motorola and DMR. Is that the particular email you're referring to, Eric? Go ahead.
Specifically about C4FM. I didn't send you the whole thick thing because along with it is Trellis and Viterbi and a few other things to make it happen, but I just wanted you to see the basic concepts of the modulation.
From what you know right now, Eric, if you projected 10 years from now, make a guess as to what percentage of the 2 meter 440 amateur radio population are going to be using DMR because it's got such great advantages. Is it going to be 50% using it because this is the latest and the greatest? They're going to abandon analog modulation. Make a guess, Eric. KE2EJ, KQLAW.
Well, you got to consider that DMR is driven by the commercial world. It was created by ESCI, which is a European standards organization that actually developed the system. Other people have joined the club, so to speak. But it's really aimed at the commercial world. It's not aimed at the amateur market. So right now, if you buy a Motorola radio, it costs you a lot of bucks. If you buy a Chinese radio, it's going to cost you half a lot of bucks, but it's still going to be a reasonable amount of dollars. Because the manufacturing of the commercial use they're not allowed to allow you to change frequencies and do that kind of stuff. You know, it's all that reprogrammed. The codec that they use, I think, stinks, but that's my opinion. But we actually have better codecs, the vocoders that they call them, now that are far superior to what this is. You don't forget this is already 15, 20 years old in terms of the technology that's been developed. So I see us approaching saturation in the next 2 or 3 years, and then I see it drop off. At least that's my prediction, anyway.
In that so-called saturation and drop-off, do you think as many as half of the 450 operators are going to be trying this and then not backing away from it? Or is it going to be 10%? What's your guess, Eric Glad?
No, I would probably say that the people who are currently using it are absolutely in love with it, and they're not going to go anywhere. Me being a hard of hearing person, it doesn't excite me all that much. Actually, the P25 or the ASU, which uses twice the bandwidth in terms of creating voice, much better on my ears. It makes me a happier camper. But don't forget, there are competing methods in terms of what you can go to the radio store and buy, and the ham radio stores, and I'm not aware that you can buy any BMR stuff from the ham radio stores at this point. I'm sure it's going to get there, because the DMR network is pretty widespread. It's very widespread in Europe. We don't have a lot of D-Star here, but if you go to Japan, you'd be hard-pressed to find an analog with you. And they're totally saturated. Don't forget, D-Star was developed by the Japan Amateur Radio League. They licensed ICOM, and nobody else wanted to pick up the lights because they're doing other stuff like Kenwood's doing P25 and Yaesu's doing P25 and PMO. But that's the commercial product. That's not the amateur radio product. So, you know, market forces decide what happens here. Troy, WKK2K.
I thank you, Eric. John, I think you wanted to add something to all of the above. KC2WTB, K2LIW.
KC2WTB. Yes, Dick, I don't know if this would help Eric, but that coil he was talking about, that spiral wound coil, Tektronix and one of their high frequency waveform generators had a coil similar to that, and they didn't want it to radiate, and they folded it back on itself. So if you were to draw that on a piece of paper, that spiral, the back of the paper would have that absorptive material that you want. Then they would fold it so that that would increase, double the thickness of the absorptive coil, and the coil would be folded back on itself. And that was supposedly to reduce radiation. And it was a very thin package. I don't know if that would help, Eric, but I've seen that done. May not apply, but just some info.
That's an interesting idea.
Do you happen to remember what brand name that was, John?
T2WGB. Yes, Dave, it was a Tektronix product. It was a waveform generator that I saw. It was a little black package. It was approximately 2 inches tall and maybe 1.5 inches wide. It had a few other items in there, but when you opened it, if you cut it open, there was that little copper spiral coil that was wound back. Now, I don't know who made it for Tektronix. They may have made it themselves. I'm not sure. But that was a couple of years ago. I don't have a part number or anything like that, but it's just an idea of folding it back on itself might help.
Reminds me a little bit of some of the techniques that have been used in the past on wire-wound high-power resistors. In order to have it a pure resistor and not act like a solenoid inductor, they use various techniques of reversing the winding in order to cancel the magnetic field being generated. Try to make it more like a nichrome resistive wire wound high power resistor. So there's a lot of fancy things you can do once you understand what the fields and waves looks like inside. Okay, the next person on our list was Roger, K2 Juliet Alpha Sierra. Go right ahead, Roger. K2 RIW the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Okay, good evening, Dick. Nice to make your acquaintance this time, and I was listening earlier when you were discussing